This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, after spending over 50 years as a reporter and journalism professor, Charlie Wheeler talks with us about the past and the future of the business.
I find it sad and I find it troubling because I think the success of our system depends on an informed public, not people who get their information from somebody's Facebook post because he heard it from his neighbor who overheard it at the barbershop 3 weeks ago.
More women see opportunity in becoming truck drivers. We'll hear from some who have decided to drive the big rigs. We'll tag along as researchers look for an elusive Midwestern snake. You might not realize it, but wind energy has a waste problem, we'll explain. And many towns in Illinois have worked to restore old theaters. We'll visit one of them. That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, more women are taking to the road as truck drivers. There's opportunity behind the wheel. We'll have that story. Also, a visit to a small-town theater, one of several in Illinois that's been restored. We'll hear about the benefit it brings to the community. And we go on a hunt for a venomous but hard-to-find snake right here in the Midwest. All of that and more still to come on Statewide. Well, few people have been following Illinois state government as long as Charlie Wheeler. For more than two decades at the Chicago Sun-Times to nearly three more heading the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Charlie has seen the heyday and gradual decline of State House news coverage. For our Illinois Issues report this week, we're about to hear excerpts from a speech Charlie gave on the subject earlier this year. He also sat down to talk about the future of state government news coverage with our State House reporter, Brian Mackey.
In 1969, Charlie Wheeler was just back from 3 years in the Peace Corps. He wanted to get into newspapers, a career he'd been pursuing since high school, and got hired at the Chicago Sun-Times. They soon dispatched him to Springfield to cover the Illinois Constitutional Convention.
When I first started, the press room was located in the state capitol in what had formerly been the Illinois State Library. And there were several dozen cubicles, each of which had one or two reporters with typewriters. So you'd walk in here to typewriters chattering away.
Charlie's been covering the Illinois State House ever since.
So it was a pretty lively place, and it was a major, major operation. There were probably 40 or more full-time reporters back then.
In his five decades as a reporter and teacher of reporters, Charlie has seen the Statehouse Press Corps strangled by twin forces of technology and malevolent ownership. He reflected on all this in a speech earlier this year at a Hall of Fame reception for the University of Illinois Springfield's Public Affairs Reporting Program, which Charlie led from 1993 until his retirement just last month. Here he is talking to a room full of colleagues and former students about how he landed in Springfield.
After the convention was over, they needed somebody to come down and cover the legislative session in 1971. I was the only guy in the city room who'd been to Springfield before and was willing to go back. But when I started, there were five daily newspapers in Chicago, all of whom had a bureau here in Springfield. There were two St. Louis papers that had a bureau here in Springfield. Two wire services with a bureau. The network affiliates here in central Illinois had a bureau. There were a couple of radio networks, plus local radio stations had bureaus. And even WGN-TV had a bureau, full-time guy down here in the state capitol. That has all changed.
Charlie says one of the keys to this bounty of coverage was the fact that most newspapers were private companies owned by families.
That model is pretty much gone everywhere. They went through a phase when they were public ownership, and now they're owned by, a lot of them are owned, the big media companies are owned by private equity investors, for whom putting out a newspaper is no more different than making dog food or soap flakes. They have no sense of community. It's all about the bottom line.
It seems to me one of the key differences here is where the owners think their responsibility lies.
Yeah, I think there's a big distinction between a family-owned newspaper and one that's owned by some private equity group located maybe hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from the community that the newspaper ostensibly serves. As a matter of fact, the publisher of the Joliet Herald News, when I was a paper boy, was on my paper route. And so they were familiar with the community. Nowadays, you have absentee ownership, and now you have private equity, which I liken private equity firms who come in to the people who run chop shops with automobiles, stolen automobiles. They break them down and sell the parts. In my mind, these equity investors come in, they'll buy up some community newspaper, they'll cut costs everywhere by laying off reporters, laying off, outsourcing the printing, so you no longer have printers and pressmen. And ultimately, they declare bankruptcy and fold the paper.
Greedy absentee ownership is only part of the story. Evolving technology also plays a role. When Charlie was just getting started, the press room had its own Western Union operator.
Because back in those days, people filed their stories via telegraph, Western Union. And it wasn't until I had been there for probably 15 or more years that we switched to computers.
But the most consequential changes to the media brought on by technology are not in how reporters write and file stories. The more important changes are in how people consume the news. Remember that paper route?
We delivered papers after school in the afternoon because most newspapers were afternoon newspapers. And then with the advent, the widespread advent and availability of television, people didn't have to rely on the newspaper to get the afternoon news. They could get it more quickly and more up to date just by watching TV news. And so gradually, afternoon newspapers became morning newspapers. And then it was accelerated, I think, with the advent of the internet and the ability to go online and see what happened just moments ago. And that accelerated the decline, I believe, in the print media's circulation and availability.
There's also Craigslist and eBay supplanting classified ads, and the shift of advertising from newspapers to the likes of Google and Facebook. Put it all together, and according to an analysis by the Boston Globe, over the last 20 years, the newspaper industry has endured steeper job losses than coal mining.
And we all are familiar with that. We've all seen our shops been reduced. We've all seen papers that used to publish 7 days a week now do six or five.
I asked Charlie if he ever has an emotional reaction to the hollowing out of the press corps.
Yeah, I find it sad and I find it troubling because I think the success of our system depends on an informed public, not people who get their information from somebody's Facebook post because he heard it from his neighbor who overheard it at the barbershop 3 weeks ago, but from people who are there reporting and people who are committed to reporting facts, verifying the details of what they're going to be reporting, or to use one of my pet phrases, people who read the bill. They don't write about stuff unless they know what they're writing about.
I guess last question, are you optimistic about the future of State House coverage or more pessimistic?
I think it's evolving, and I think we're moving away from the, if you will, the for-profit, corporate-driven, all about milking every last dime out of the operation we can, to more a scenario, if you will, of kind of public journalism. Here in Illinois, we have an operation called Capital News Illinois. The purpose is to provide the kind of coverage that once upon a time was covered by bureaus which no longer exist. And it's been phenomenally successful. Now, that to me is a model for the future. And in a way, it's just like public radio.
I'm a firm believer in this, how important it is. And I still see myself as a reporter. And I look at you folks who are going to be carrying on this legacy. You're going to carry this forward, and it's going to be on your shoulders that the responsibility will fall to continue to provide the information that people need to be able to govern themselves.
Charlie Wheeler has just retired after 50 years covering Illinois government as State House reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times and director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. I'm Brian Mackey.
Illinois healthcare officials want to save money by changing the kind of insurance the Department of Children and Family Services provides to children in its care. But state lawmakers say they're worried those kids may fall through the cracks. Sam Dunklaw reports.
If you've ever moved from one insurance plan to another, you know it can be complicated. Now try doing that for 16,000 foster care children at once. That's what DCFS is trying to manage for all the kids in its custody. It wants to move them all to Illinois' Medicaid plan, known as Illini Care. But state lawmakers say that plan is not soup yet.
The road to hell was paved with good intentions, and I'm sure you have that. But you are experimenting with my children's lives, and I'm sick of it.
That was Mary Flowers, a Chicago Democrat. She and others raised questions about whether DCFS has gotten public feedback on its plan and whether it would result in an Illini Care profit. Nonetheless, the agency is planning to make the move to Medicaid by November 1st. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
You're listening to Statewide. Western Illinois University added a new piece of equipment it says will benefit students as well as people living throughout that region. Rich Egger tells us more.
The university bought a dual polarization Doppler radar. It sits atop Memorial Hall, which is five stories tall. Radina Finch is a professor of meteorology at Western. We talked on the building's roof.
I've never done an interview on a roof, but here we are on the roof of Memorial Hall. What are we looking at here?
Well, what we in the geography department have up here, we've got the dual polarization Doppler radar. And basically what the radar is, it is a tower, which is probably about 4 feet tall. And then the radar itself is about 4 feet tall. The radar has a lot of mechanical instrument things inside of it. And so when they actually installed the radar, they had the dome off initially so they could hook everything up. And then they put the dome back on.
What purpose does the dome serve?
Well, the dome basically protects the delicate instruments inside. The dome is made of a special material so that the radar energy can go through the dome and then come back and give us the signals that we need.
It almost looks like a little bell tower, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely.
What type of equipment did this replace?
We had an old weather radar. It's probably 25 years old, and it was reflectivity only, which means that it would show you where the precipitation was located and where the precipitation was moving to. But the Doppler component also shows you how things inside the cloud itself are moving. So you can see rotation, for example, if you've got a possible tornado. And so that's a first for us.
So when we read these warnings from the Weather Service and it says radar indicated hazard, that's what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. In addition to that, we've got what's called dual polarization capability. So this radar sends out a vertical beam and a horizontal beam simultaneously. And what this does is it looks at the raindrops, the precipitation, and it sees what shape they are. And so for the first time, we can pick out the difference between large rain and hail.
How does this help in what you're teaching students?
This is actually an amazing opportunity for our students. For the first time, they'll be able to see locally how things are changing inside the storm, how things are moving, how the storm evolves. And based on that, we can go look at larger weather maps and figure out why.
Well, will you eventually be able to expand the view, how far out you can see?
Well, right now we have it set to 50 kilometers, which is roughly 30 miles. Once we get the calibration done, then we'll be able to set it out to 70 kilometers, which is 43 miles. And that will be the maximum range for this radar. But it's pretty nice because it fills what we call a radar hole. Radar coverage for West Central Illinois is terrible.
Why is that?
Well, because by the time the National Weather Service radar beam gets this far, about 80 miles from their radar, it's only seeing the middle and the tops of the clouds.
So will you be collaborating with the National Weather Service?
Definitely. And once we get the radar imagery online live streaming, the Weather Service will have access to our radar data, and they're actually the ones who will issue the watches and warnings and things like that.
Why did you choose the roof of Memorial Hall to set up this equipment? Is there a particular reason for that?
Part of that is because this is where the old radar was. And so we knew, based on the old radar, that the view 360 degrees around is pretty good. There weren't a lot of hard targets to cause ground clutter. The other reason is because it's got a surface big enough that we can put the radar. The new radar is significantly bigger than the old radar, so we're using the elevator shaft roof.
Is this high ground in the county also, or close to being the high ground in the county?
Yes, definitely. We're on top of a hill right here. And then we're on top of a tall building.
You mentioned earlier how students will benefit from this new equipment. What about the larger community? How will it benefit?
One of the things that I had in mind when I started working to get a radar 15 years ago is that we are in a radar hole. And so the radar here coverage is not very good. Occasionally tornadoes happen that don't get warned. Sometimes the severe thunderstorm warning happens after the thunderstorm has already moved through the area. And so one of the things that I wanted to do, other than create educational opportunities, is create a community resource.
So this is something that's being used by McDonough County Emergency Services?
Yes. McDonough County Emergency Services, they're actually working on a website now that will live stream the radar data. And it's not just McDonough County. Any of the counties in West Central Illinois within a 43-mile radius will have access to this data. And I think that's really important. The more people who can see the data, you know, the more lives we're likely to save.
Radina Finch is a professor of meteorology in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Geographic Information Sciences at Western Illinois University. She says it might be next month before the live web stream of the new Doppler radar is running. The radar was paid for in part with money from a trust fund established by a former faculty member. Finch says McDonough Power Cooperative also contributed to the project, and some money was raised through a crowdfunding campaign. Finch says no other university in the state has its own dual polarization Doppler radar. Rich Ecker reporting.
Stay with us coming up next here on Statewide, examining war through arts, and later, keeping the marquee lit on older theaters. There's more of Statewide on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. Still ahead, most truckers are men, but we'll introduce you to some women who are getting into the profession. And later, a small town saves its theater. That and more, still coming up on Statewide. The Northern Illinois University Art Museum's current exhibition explores aspects of war, before, during, and after. That subject is personal for some of the artists, as Guy Stevens tells us more.
Peter Olson, assistant director of the NIU Art Museum, shows me a room filled with photographs. Arranged in groups of three, the larger-than-life close-ups of young men, British soldiers who had been deployed to Afghanistan, stare straight out at you.
These are portraits of the same person before combat, during combat, and after combat. And sometimes you can see a dramatic change in their faces.
In a way, he says, they are a memorial, not to someone dead, but to an earlier self. Pre-combat, who no longer exists. That's true of the next piece, too. Large, upright wooden beams like sentinels surround a glass case holding a set of battered, worn boots. Olson says they belong to the artist, a veteran of many years of combat.
So in a sense, this too is a portrait, even though it's not a traditional portrait like an oil painting of a person's bust or something like that. And it's very much about his experience, but it's also sort of universal.
In the next room, a swirling sculpture, like a huge bird's nest made up of plywood guns covered with allusions to Bosnia and Columbine, that Olson says is a comment on not just war, but gun culture in general. A set of what looks to be family portraits here are a bit surreal. Why does each one include someone wearing an odd, even disturbing mask? Stuart Henn is marketing and education coordinator for the museum. He says the masks worn by the veterans in the pictures were created by them in a workshop,
where they were able to non-verbally express things that they can't express verbally and wear visibly on the outside the things that they're carrying with them on the inside.
Then there's a ceramic piece, an American flag made like a jigsaw puzzle. Six of the pieces have fallen out of it. Olson says the artist was deployed in Iraq, and the six represent people in his platoon, three who died in combat, three who committed suicide after their return to the U.S.
That's something we can all sort of think about, the implications of combat. It's not just about what happens during an actual combat situation, but what is life like afterwards.
In contrast, a nearby sculpture makes you smile when you realize what it is, a crab made out of motorcycle chain, a wrench, and bolts. Olson says the artist, a combat veteran who was trained to do metalworking while in the service, suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome afterwards.
And he actually found that he could use the skills that he had learned in the military to make sort of like found object kind of whimsical sculptures. The experience that caused his trauma was also the key to his healing.
But look up from the crab and you are confronted by a huge painting. Bright, almost harsh colors, wild shapes. Are those tentacles? The title contains a clue, a reference to the Roman god of war. It's unsettling. How much, Olson says, depends on the individual.
I've never been in a combat situation, so I can't say this is what it feels like, but that is what other people have said about this piece, and I just find it to be a very arresting kind of experience to just stand in front of it.
There are other pieces here. Some are pretty clear, or at least seeming so. Some not clear at all, and most sending mixed, often very personal messages. Stuart Henn says the artists in this show demonstrate the power of the medium to express such a vast subject as war on a human scale.
The interesting thing about the visual arts is that they help us grapple with complex issues. It's not just about patriotism, it's not just about protest, but it's both and.
And Peter Olson says if that leaves people with more questions than answers, well, when it comes to something like war, maybe that's not such a bad thing. I'm Guy Stevens.
The American Trucking Association estimates the industry is short at least 50,000 drivers nationwide. It estimates that number could even triple by 2024 as older drivers retire. And that presents an opportunity for those with only a high school diploma willing to invest a few months of training and a few thousand dollars to earn middle-class money. Only about 6% of American truck drivers are female, but a number of Central Illinois women are taking advantage of the employment opportunity. John Norton of member station WGLT first reported the story in the spring, and we bring it to you today.
Can you see him better on the side?
Yeah.
On a large parking lot behind Midwest Food Bank in Normal, Holly Hayes, Seven Headley, and Dawn Grief are 4 weeks into their truck driver training through Heartland Community College. They're working toward a Class A commercial driver's license.
Find what you're looking for?
Tie rod. Where's the tie rod?
The big bar that goes through there, and then the little one behind it. The bar that goes across from that is the axle.
Okay.
And the round pipe behind it is the tie rod.
Oh, okay, I see now.
Trainer Dave Keim is working with the women on a pleasant spring day. Those three students and two instructors are inspecting the Volvo semi-truck and trailer adorned with the Heartland Community College logo ahead of a training run on Bloomington Normal streets. Bloomington's Holly Hayes is typical of many who get into trucking. The allure of a nationwide median salary of $45,000 is three times the federal minimum wage. The median $86,000 salary of private fleet drivers can quickly put someone solidly into the middle class. Hayes currently drives a school bus part-time in District 87.
Well, my family's already in the industry, and they set a great example. You know, they were able to provide a livable income. And driving a school bus, I can't do that.
I guess it was making a decent salary.
That's Debbie Hale of Pontiac. She currently drives for Hudson-based Nussbaum Trucking and is a graduate of the Heartland Community College truck driver training. She was in Illinois on this day, driving between Champaign and Peoria, but pulled over to talk. Like Hayes, she drove a school bus. But she switched to big rigs after she and her husband were in a traffic accident and he lost a leg.
My children were grown and I'm like, I need to do something besides drive a school bus. I need to bring in some more income.
The promise of a better income is a pretty common motivation. Ellen Voya is president and CEO of the Women in Trucking Association, Incorporated. That's a Wisconsin-based nonprofit industry group that takes dues from both truckers and trucking companies.
The money is the number one reason women come into the industry. They know they can make the same amount of money as men.
And somewhat surprisingly, in this still very male-dominated business, Voya says there is no gender pay gap, as drivers are mostly paid by the mile.
But I will tell you that women actually make more money than men in this industry. And the reason is because they're running more miles. or they're running more loads, or they're running more efficiently.
Voya is hinting the attributes women bring to truck driving make them a logical recruiting target for truck companies and a chance for many to bring home a decent paycheck. Desiree Ann Wood says that money can look pretty inviting.
But we don't work 40-hour work weeks.
Wood is president of the advocacy group Real Women in Trucking Incorporated. She was driving through Lancaster, Pennsylvania on her way to South Florida during this headset conversation.
We work 70-hour work weeks on the books, but we do a lot of unpaid labor off the books, which can be another 20 or 30 hours. That's a lot of work for $55,000 a year.
Wood is an owner-operator and mostly a long-haul driver. She said the $55,000 figure is likely high for those early in their career. She concedes salaries can be higher for private fleet drivers, but cautions most companies will only consider hiring those drivers after they've driven a couple hundred thousand accident-free miles. So back to the metrics. Female truck drivers as a whole are statistically more productive and safer than their male counterparts. Ellen Voya says the science of the fear response helps explain that.
Just because we activate the amygdala faster, you know, that's the fear center. We also are more team-oriented.
And she says testosterone can sometimes work against male truck drivers.
So women are less likely to get road rage. Carriers tell me that women are easier to train because they don't have that I know how to do it attitude. Women are also better with equipment. Women are better with the paperwork, and women are better with customers.
And they tend to stay with a company longer. Driver Debbie Hale of Pontiac isn't surprised by the safety numbers.
It's like I'm driving down there, and it's like, you know, hey, that's somebody's kid. For the most part, more mothering, more nurturing, we're more careful overall.
We are back at the Midwest Food Bank parking lot. Devin Davis of Strawn, Illinois, is the other Heartland Community College instructor working with the women students.
I pointed out that one.
Davis is well aware of the positive safety and efficiency metrics for women. He also notices female students approach learning differently than men.
Women try to be perfect. Other men don't care. They just try it and mess up.
The students say that's not always been true.
I think we've all been pretty hands-on, just went for it. We've all killed the truck a couple times, ran over some cones.
I haven't killed it yet.
Well, me and Holly have.
Davis also says trucking companies are telling him they want more female drivers.
Yeah, they want more women because they need younger drivers. 18-year-old men, they're not good drivers. At least 18-year-old women would be better at it.
Still, recent statistics show women make up just 6 to 8% of non-male truck drivers. It's a number that has nudged up from 4% in 2010. But why, despite the trend, is that number still low and sticky? One reason is the nature of the job. Long-haul drivers can be away from home for days or even weeks at a time. And with women still considered primary care parents for children and the elderly, long-haul truck driving can be impractical. Desiree Ann Wood of Real Women in Trucking says driving an 80,000-pound vehicle through snow, wind, and rain can be a deterrent, as can other more mundane daily routines.
You're not going to be able to have a shower every day. You might have to brush your teeth with a cup of water out in the parking lot. A lot of life's luxuries are going to go away because your life starts being living around the load.
Then there is the safety issue, both personal for being on the road alone for long periods of time and professional. As fleet operators continue to struggle to fill available truck driving jobs, training companies and finishing schools run by those fleet operators also struggle to find trainers who can pass background checks. Wood says isolation in a small cab with someone who has the power to decide if you make the team has led to some unsavory results and lawsuits.
Trainers and co-drivers coercing, badgering, forcing sex on students that don't know. They are in a life situation that makes them unable to just hop off the truck in the middle of the desert.
To attract more female drivers, carriers say they are offering more practice time in truck driving simulators. They've added more internal support groups, female truck driver liaisons, and trainers. But Wood says female trainers aren't necessarily the answer.
The trainers that are qualified, who are safe, who are held accountable, are the answer. There's a lot of really good men trainers, but they do need the support of the company.
Nussbaum trucking driver Debbie Hale of Pontiac says her company has been very supportive of her. She believes the dominant share of male truck drivers and the isolation she can feel on the job make it important women not only have support groups, but other women to offer that support. She says she has had a couple of incidents where she felt her safety was at risk, but she says she has also received support from other male drivers in her short 6 months on the road.
Like, especially when I first started, you know, there's been some guys that have been, hey, you know, yeah, you're doing fine, and or have helped me out in little ways, and I've been appreciative of it.
So those are some of the internal challenges forward-thinking trucking companies are trying to iron out to create a welcoming environment for women. Ellen Voya of the Women in Trucking Association says companies are also beginning to understand if they want to attract women truck drivers, the message has to resonate.
I actually wrote a blog called Women Are Not Small Men. The companies that don't get it want to assume that women will adapt to the male-dominated environment.
A scan of trucking firm websites, either listing Bloomington Normal as home base or national firms with locations in town, reveals those companies aren't yet including women as at least one of the faces of trucking. Just one company included images of females in truck driver or non-office positions. A couple show men of color. There are a lot of images of white males. Voya says there are also a lot of marketing misses in recruiting ads.
We'll get you home to your wife and kids, or one said we're looking for a few good mustaches. They're not putting the ads where women might see them. They're not appealing to women by using words and images that will attract women in the industry.
Having said all that, women are still entering the truck driving business. In addition to a respectable salary, truck drivers say it's a great way to see the country. For example, driver Debbie Hale says she fell in love with the landscape of central South Dakota.
When I was coming up with my trainer and I'm looking around, I'm like, oh my gosh, I love this. I want to move here. My husband's like, I come home, I'm like, oh, I love South Dakota. I want to move there. He's looking at me like, no, absolutely not.
Heartland Community College student Holly Hayes also anticipates seeing the country once she earns her CDL.
I like the open road. I like listening to my music. I love kids. They're great. It's going to be sad to leave them behind, but I'm just fine by myself.
Companies and drivers occasionally use other ways to make truck driving welcoming. Heartland student Dawn Grief lives in Chenoa. She wants to use her Class A license to form a long-hauling team with her soon-to-be husband, driving for Hinton, Iowa-based Weinrich Truck Lines.
We don't get to spend enough time together, so we decided that this was a great way to get to see the world because we're both young enough to be able to do it, and anything on the continent is fair game.
And the company is on board with that?
As long as I pass all my background checks and everything, then yes. They hired him with the intention that we would be coming as a team eventually, once the school year was over.
Ellen Voya of Women in Trucking says there are a number of husband-wife team drivers in the U.S. One is often sleeping while the other is driving, so they don't spend as much awake time with each other as you might think. But she says team drivers can make a lot more money because they can go a longer distance faster.
The government has hours of service regulations so that if you're a solo driver, you can't be over 14 hours on duty. But if you're a team and, you know, one of them's driving for 12 hours and the other one's driving for 12 hours, you can move that freight pretty fast.
The third trainee this semester at Heartland Community College intends to utilize her CDL short term.
My name is Seven Headley. I'm from Fairbury, Illinois, and I graduated from Prairie Central High School in 2015.
Headley is also a junior accounting major at Illinois Wesleyan University.
Well, I need to learn how to drive a semi because my parents own a carnival company, and so we have to haul the rides, and my mom and dad both have their CDL, so they need someone else to help them out.
Headley actually passed the written test 2 years ago, but let it expire when family members were too busy to train her.
And then I came here, and I got my permit again, and now I'm learning how to drive.
Real Women in Trucking founder Desiree Wood has pointed critiques and advice. Wood says women with small children or young women who plan to have children should really think it through before signing up. She also urges women to do their own background checks on the trucking companies before applying. In her experience, she says companies that advertise the most are the worst.
And the ones that are actually the best get very little exposure.
But Wood also adds that trucking is an honorable, purposeful job. She says knowing food on supermarket shelves and products in other stores are there because people like her drive across the country through all sorts of conditions is a feeling difficult to replicate in other jobs. Driver Debbie Hale of Pontiac, who trained through Heartland Community College and is now 6 months into her long-haul career, agrees.
To me, I feel we are a big part of the economy. I had seen a sticker last week. It said, if you don't like truckers, then don't buy
stop.
I pointed out that one, and then I pointed out one.
For WGLT News, I'm John Norton.
But there's two more on this side, right?
Women in Trucking President and CEO Ellen Voya also says there are upward mobility possibilities for female truck drivers. She sees drivers moving into logistics and driver training and says her organization works to help women become trucking company owners.
When I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard, I got my diesel wound up and she's running like I never before. There's a speed zone ahead, but all right, I don't see a cop in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight.
Up next, keeping the marquee lit on older theaters. There's more of Statewide on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The copperhead snake can be hard to locate, but researchers are trying to track it. We'll have more on that story, and a problem you might not know about when it comes to wind turbines. All of that and more ahead on Statewide. Well, up next, across the country, local volunteers are working to restore rundown theaters to their old luster, often with the hope their community will benefit as well. Today we visit one such theater in Hoopston, a small town north of Danville once known for its canning factories. For many Hoopston residents, the town's old movie theater brings back memories of brighter days, as Jim Meadows reports.
It's a quiet Saturday night in downtown Hoopston, except at the Lorraine Theater, where Elvis is in the building. Not Elvis Presley, but tribute artist Doug Church, billed as the true voice of Elvis, making his third appearance at the Lorraine Theater. The audience is short of a capacity crowd, but high on enthusiasm.
Thank you very much.
Doug Church is a professional entertainer, but the people running the Lorraine Theater are all volunteers who say they're learning as they go, like Alex Homis, who ran lights for the concert, including some newly installed ones he had just figured out how to use.
We're constantly evolving and learning from what we've done previously because none of us have theater experience. We just all love the theater and we all love our community, and we're just basically doing the best we can, right, and learning as we're going. And we've learned quite a lot, and we've come a long ways.
Homis is on the board of the Save the Lorraine Foundation, which acquired the 98-year-old theater after it closed its doors in 2012, with some help from a local benefactor. Retired high school teacher Jim Richards is the board president.
We were not known citizens of the community. We weren't on the city council. We weren't the affluent people of the city. Just a group of people that cared about the Lorraine that got together. And we met right out here in the front of the Lorraine in the lobby.
Actually, since the Save the Lorraine Foundation got started, board member Alex Homis has been elected to the Hoopston City Council. The foundation has made extensive repairs to the Lorraine over the years, from tuck pointing to restoring its 1930s Art Deco interior. The restoration is a work in progress, but board member Marilyn Tyler says what they've done so far brings back memories of going to the Lorraine on dates with her future first husband, when he was a projectionist there.
Well, it's even cooler when the lights are all on, when it gets dark and you see the lights on the street that haven't been here for years. We almost get teary-eyed when you see it like it was when we were kids.
Besides tributes to Elvis, the revived Lorraine Theater has hosted local events ranging from school board candidate forums to the Miss Hoopston pageant, as well as private functions like weddings. But bringing movies back to the Lorraine remains an expensive dream, due to the cost of today's digital movie projection systems. Instead, the Save the Lorraine Foundation is showing movies down the street.
This is Burke, the best-kept secret this side of, well, anywhere.
That's How to Train Your Dragon 2, projected from a DVD at the Little Lorraine. The 48-seat storefront theater opened about 20 years ago to fulfill the Lorraine Theater's contracts for less popular movies. Board member Alex Homis says he believes the weekend movies at the Little Lorraine and the live shows every month or so in the main theater have encouraged other businesses to open up in downtown Hoopston. Board President Jim Richards sees another benefit. He's been moved by Lorraine concerts that involve local people, like a Christian music concert in May that featured performers from local churches.
And it's just a miracle what you hear coming from them, the music and the songs and the spirit. And I just think this theater just gives love back to them. you can just feel the vibes from them when they're on the stage, and it just brings the best of them out.
In addition to money it sometimes makes in concerts and movies, the Save the Lorraine Foundation relies mostly on local donations and fundraising events to keep its theaters open. The Little Lorraine reopens this month after undergoing renovations, including risers for the back seats. The next big show at the Lorraine Theater is a Beach Boys tribute band in October. I'm Jim Meadows.
Next week, Jim takes us to the Virginia Theater in Champaign. You can hear that here on Statewide. For environmentalists, wind energy is the crown jewel of renewable resources until it's time to close the wind farm down. And as Christina Stella with Harvest Public Media reports, wind energy's waste problem is counterintuitive to the industry's green mission.
Wind energy has more than tripled in the U.S. over the last 10 years. It's become a major investment for all kinds of corporations to signal their environmental savvy to customers, from the Gap to Budweiser.
The answer is blowing in the wind.
But what happens when a wind farm shuts down, or the turbines reach their 20-year life cycle? At the Kimball Wind Farm in southwestern Nebraska, Rob Van Bleet is planning the day's work, scrapping thousands of pounds worth of old wind turbine blades. Rob says most of a turbine does get recycled, but when it's time to throw away the blades, that's when things get complicated and costly.
Taking things apart is difficult. It took a lot of energy to put it together. It's going to take a lot to take it apart. This job in particular, there are 100 semi-loads of material that need to be removed. That's very expensive to move.
Plus, because the blades are so big, scrappers have to rent or build specialized trucks to take them to a landfill. But blades can be anywhere from 100 to 300 feet long, so sometimes landfills need to build extra space for them. That drives the price even higher for scrappers and puts landfills in a tight spot.
So if you're a small utility or municipality, let's say, and all of a sudden hundreds of blades start to come to your landfill, you don't want to use up your capacity for your local municipal trash for wind turbine blades.
Turbine blades are also built to withstand all kinds of weather, especially in the windy Midwest and Great Plains. A mix of resin and fiberglass makes them tough but pliable, similar to what spaceship parts are made from.
They're made out of an incredibly strong fiberglass. So the company brought one in as a demo for us to try to crush. And actually, our crushing equipment is not big enough to crush them.
That's Cindy Langstrom, who manages a specialized landfill for wind farm waste in Wyoming. She says the blade's strength can make it hard for landfills to efficiently break them down.
We talked about cutting them into three different pieces because it made the rates way too high to rent. The big crushing machines you see in mines, we just don't have that kind of equipment. It's expensive to rent.
Researchers have estimated we'll have over 720,000 tons of blade material to dispose of in the U.S. over the next 20 years. That doesn't include the number of how many turbines will be replaced with new, higher capacity ones. Carl England, a researcher and CTO of Global Fiberglass Solutions, says U.S. companies looking to recycle blades don't have options right now because the industry here is still young.
In the States, you know, the wind industry is coming on, but we haven't had a lot of decommissioned wind farms. And you go to places like Europe where it's denser and land is at a premium, and you're not allowed to throw things away, so you have to do it.
But England says he's developed a way to repurpose blades by grinding them up to make chocolate chip-sized poly pellets.
That can be used in a lot of different plastic parts like decking board and pallets and piping and those kind of things.
The startup opened their first processing facility in Central Texas this year and have leased a second space near Des Moines, Iowa. Back in Nebraska, Van Vliet will keep experimenting too, in the hope that blade recycling can blossom into a local industry.
Out on the prairie, there's not very much scrap. The idea is to develop the next technology. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. We lose money on every blade we haul.
For rural areas that need an economic boost, Van Vliet thinks his risk of recycling just might pay off. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
SIU trustees poured over enrollment and budget updates from each campus during a working session this week, and leaders on the board say they're pleased to see some progress. Despite enrollment declines on both the Carbondale and Edwardsville campuses, trustees say they're impressed with how the schools are working to restore the losses and keep the students once they arrive. Trustee Roger Tedrick says there is momentum and he sees positive results in the future.
What hits me specifically is this is common sense stuff. And this is what we all want. This is how we want to be treated. So we're going to be able to measure that in years to come.
Retention rates were up across the SIU system, and Tedrick says he expects that will continue. Other public universities have reported their enrollment numbers for the current semester, and the result is a mixed bag. A series titled Enrollment Exodus will air later this month on most of these stations. We'll look at the reasons why many Illinois colleges and universities have seen dramatic drops in enrollment in recent years and possible solutions. We'll also recap that series right here on Statewide. Only a few snakes in Illinois are venomous, like the copperhead, which is mostly found in the southern part of the state, but the species can be incredibly hard to find, and that makes it difficult to study. St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan met the small team of researchers hoping to learn more about the elusive copperhead snake.
As he prepares for surgery, Chris Hanley listens closely to his patient's heartbeat.
We're just giving some fluids and some pain management, some analgesics, and some antibiotics before surgery.
The St. Louis Zoo veterinarian adjusts his face mask and lays out his tools on the table, waiting for the anesthesia to take effect. His patient is a young copperhead snake that weighs about as much as a half stick of butter. Hanley is implanting a radio transmitter into the snake's body.
The trickiest part in these little snakes is getting it into the body cavity. You don't want to just go under the skin because the body will kick it out very easily like a splinter.
It's part of a research study tracking the movements of copperhead snakes in the St. Louis region. The copperhead is the most common venomous snake in Missouri, but we know surprisingly little about its basic biology. How does it find a mate? Where does it live? How many are there?
It's like putting together a puzzle where you always get more pieces added in. And the picture just keeps growing and growing.
Ben Jelen is leading the snake tracking study. He's a biology professor at the St. Louis College of Pharmacy. The idea is simple, at least in theory. Tag wild copperheads with radio transmitters, put them back where you found them, and then see where they go. That's how we end up wading through shoulder-high grass at Powder Valley Nature Center in Kirkwood on a recent afternoon. Master student Brittany Nyer holds a large metal antenna that picks up the signal from the transmitters inside the snakes. The beeps from the receiver get louder and louder, which tells Nyer the snake is close by. We follow the beeps of the receiver into the forest, looking for a large adult male the team has nicknamed Captain Kirk.
Oh, I see him.
You see him?
Yeah.
Can I see him from this angle?
Even with our equipment, Captain Kirk is very hard to spot, coiled up under a fallen branch. Jelen says the species' camouflage is its best line of defense.
I think because they're so cryptic, they go undetected quite a bit. That saves you from direct persecution, like meeting the wrong end of a shovel, but it doesn't save you from habitat loss.
As humans have moved out of the cities and built homes where forests once stood, snake populations around St. Louis have been squeezed into smaller and smaller slices of habitat. Many little habitat patches, like Powder Valley, are now bordered by major roads. Bob Aldridge spent his career studying snakes in the St. Louis area. The retired St. Louis University biology professor says these small, isolated populations are at a higher risk of disappearing.
If your population is large enough, you can lose a fair number of them, and the ones that survive can spread back out. Whereas once they're isolated, that's it.
Ben Jelen doesn't know how many copperheads are at Powder Valley or how far they travel. He still has a lot of questions he wants to answer, but he says it's just as important to educate people about snakes.
One of the misconceptions is that they're really aggressive, that every snake is out to harm you or hurt you. The vast majority don't say, I see a human over there. I have to go bite it.
Jelen says he often meets people who are curious about what he's doing. A few weeks ago, a hiker stopped him and asked if the antenna he was carrying was a music stand. These conversations, he says, can help change people's minds about snakes, one at a time. I'm Shayla Farzan.
That wraps up this week Statewide. We're glad you could join us. We'll be here again next week at this time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, you can find them at our website at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available each week through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations. Thank you.